That's a Roman legion.
Oh, yeah. The Romans invaded Britain several times during this period.
Oh, I know. My favourite topic at school. Invasion of the hot Italians.
Love a Roman.
Welcome to the 11th episode of Zero Hour Strikes, the show that covers DC's 1994 crossover event, Zero Hour Crisis in Time. Every issue, every tie-in, every zero issue. I'm Siskoid.
I'm Bass.
And in this episode, we take a look at Adventures of Superman number 516 and Steel number 8. That's why I'm calling this one Men of Steel. It's back to the Superman family, Bass.
I know. It's so fun.
You like this better than the Batman family? Or is there like a grouping of books that up to now has kind of been your favorite stories?
I kind of like the fact that we come back to Superman once in a while, because Superman is pretty much central to the entire, you know, the entire crisis. But I am also a Superman fan, so I do enjoy my soups.
Yeah, we'll get more of him because there's an Action Comics tie-in as well that we haven't even covered yet. So you're right, Superman. Superman kind of shows up periodically. So we've talked about where Superman was in 94 already, but let's just say here that Adventures of Superman was named after the old TV series, obviously. It is Superman Volume 1. After Crisis, when Superman was rebooted, they wanted a new Superman number one, but they kept the first volume around and just called it Adventures of. And that's the origin of this particular book and why it's up there at number 516, when obviously it wasn't a book in the Bronze Age. Let's talk about this cover by Barry Kitson first, with Alpha Centurion and his logo splattered all over Superman, and a statue of the Alpha Centurion standing where Superman should be. Superman looks on, confused, as Lois Lane recoils from him. What do you think?
The Adventures of Superman actually has Alpha Centurion crossed over it, so we kind of know what we're getting into. Still, can't wait to read this one, because, I mean, I don't know much about Alpha Centurion, so, yeah.
Well, there's nothing to know, because I think we first saw him in Zero Hour number 3. He was in that crowd scene as one of the characters that we were going like, who the hell is that? And so this is his first full appearance.
Okay.
So he never existed before, but he has existed since. So we'll talk about that. But this is basically the take that we're going to see is parallel universe, you know, who might have been Metropolis's champion. That's what it says here. Who is Metropolis's greatest hero? And can you do that, Metropolis apostrophe S? Is that the correct English for that?
Metropolis's?
Well, I mean, shouldn't it just be like the apostrophe and then no further S? Or is Metropolis not a plural and thus still gets the apostrophe S? I need some English grammar scholars out there to answer me this. I mean, it's one of the things that bugged me about the cover. I'll tell you what the other one is. That stupid DC Universe banner in the upper right-hand corner.
Yeah.
Maybe it balances. I don't know why they have that, because we already have the DC bullet. This is a Superman book, so obviously it is not like a side universe or a side family. It's DC Universe and the Zero Hour banner on there. So it feels particularly cluttered on this, because this is a cover that also has Alpha Centurion and the A and the over the S because of the thing, and also the triangle. This is the 35th Superman book of 1994, and we need to have all of this splattered on the cover.
Yeah, it just feels like they're trying to brand the DC Universe thing.
Yes, it's like they've got like an alternate logo that is not the bullet.
I don't know. It does feel kind of awkward. It balances out, but when you first look at it, it kind of pushes the Zero Hour to one side, like slightly to one side, because of how the Superman has this weird little perspective type thing done on it.
Yeah, so it looks like Zero Hour isn't centered.
Yeah, it doesn't look centered, but it is. I'm sure it is, but it just doesn't feel centered.
I agree with you. Okay, well, let's talk about Adventures of Superman number 516, The Interior. We'll do a short synopsis here and then talk about the details. This is by Carl Kiesel, Peter Krause, and Jackson Guise, who are guest pencilers and inkers here. The cover mistakenly gives the credit to the regular team of Kitson and McCarthy, who did the cover. Another problem with that, whoever did the graphics for the cover. It's called The Hero of Metropolis, and goes a little like this. Superman goes to check on Metropolis and gets hit by lightning. Then he realizes Metropolis has changed. It's not a wreck like it's supposed to be. And when he visits the Daily Planet, nobody recognizes Clark Kent. The hero of this Metropolis is Alpha Centurion, a Roman citizen who was taken by aliens and brought back, and thanks to relativity, 2,000 years later. He became the hero of Metropolis and Lois Lane's lover. Superman helps him against his main villain, Bloody Mary. They compare notes. They head back into Zero Hour to try and fix time. Even if it means that one of them is not coming back because reality will assert itself in a certain way, is the heroic act here. It doesn't make it sound very long, but there's a good fight with Bloody Mary, and the origin of Alpha Centurion takes time as well to tell.
It was a fun issue. I kind of like the way that this alternate reality has no Superman. He has thousands of other dimension Supermen. I mean, Captain Carrot is a Superman
analog, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing in this universe, there are no Supermen, and Alpha Centurion has a whole new, I mean, it's a whole new type of superhero. He has his powers from aliens and the entire, I kind of dug it. You know, he's like a new twist on an old kind of way of having like a golden age type superhero.
They did bring in some elements that are supposed to make him feel a little bit more like Superman. So that he rockets back to Earth. He also has that origin of saving a space plane or a space shuttle here.
Oh, yeah.
And so he becomes Lois Lane's big story, and they get together. I like that there's no Lex Luthor either, or whatever happened to Luthor, because the where LexCorp should stand, that big building in the shape of an L, is actually in the shape of an A, and it's Alpha Centurion's quarters. And so he's much more of a hedonist. We see that he has, like, well, I'm going to call them slave girls, because probably that's not the case. They're probably not slaves. But he's got, you know, he's got attendants and a pool, a magical pool or a super science pool that heals him in the penthouse. And he lives in that building where LexCorp would usually stand. So there are other differences. You know, many things in the Superman mythos don't seem to have happened.
It's fun and it's weird.
At first, when you see the Alpha Centurion on the cover and all that, you think, okay, this is like a Roman classic. You know, there are a couple of classic parallel universes. You can do Nazis won World War II, and you can do the Roman Empire never fell. You know, those are classic parallel worlds. And my first thought was this, that, you know, originally, obviously, my first thought was back in 94, but my first thought would have been, okay, so this is going to be a world where the Roman Empire never fell. And so there are going to be more Roman trappings on there. It's not the case, because it fell normally. It's just that the Alpha Centurion came back later. But they do play with that idea where you can people speak or have like expressions that are Roman, or, you know, well, I think a real groaner as far as Roman references is a security system called the Eyes of March, reference to Julius Caesar, the play, Beware the Eyes of March. So that was a bit of a groaner. But I was happy to see that, you know, Perry White shouts out Great Caesar's Ghost, which is normal for him, to shout out. But I felt like if Carl Kiesel had missed that, you know, it would have been a missed opportunity. But you know, you got also like you got Lois calling Superman or Clark Kent a Brutus. So it seems like the fact that Alpha Centurion is around, I don't know, people have like a kind of a Roman interest, maybe an interest in Roman things and bringing back those expressions, maybe. I don't know. Carl Kiesel also likes to, we've seen him before, he wrote the Superboy story, and he's doing much of the same stuff here, where he's paying tribute to the past in the ways that, you know, we've got a Boring Street, we've got a named after Wayne Boring, we've got Kirby Salvage, you know, stuff like that, where he's going to use names, you know, from past creators. He did a lot of that in the Superboy issue as well. But I wonder if he might have, you know, could have changed some of those things to more, since there's no Superman, why use Superman references, you know? So maybe like the Centennial Park here is now called Centurion Park. Maybe they could have done other things in that way. I don't know. But Kiesel does a lot of other references. You know, it's a bird, and then it doesn't go the right way. It doesn't go, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. He's going to change some of the dialogue to fit the fact that there's no Superman and he seems like a new guy, the new guy in town. But it's basically classic Superman story with a fight in the middle of it, a moral dilemma, Superman feeling. it's always funny when Superman's like feeling sad because somebody else is kissing Lois Lane.
Yeah, yeah.
Although his own kisses, I got to say... Whatever he's doing there on page 3, 4.
Well, that's a full-on assault in that universe.
Well, she feels like, yeah, she's being assaulted because she doesn't know who Clark Kent is. And it's funny because, you know, she calls him like a muscle-bound cretin because in this era, Clark Kent is like a football star. They acknowledge that he's big, you know, yeah. For her to have that first impression there. Still, the art makes it like he's trying to eat her face.
Well, it's a very passionate, too passionate maybe, kiss. And it's awkward. It's very awkward. You know, these types of kisses, it's just too much.
In the workplace? Even if it were like the real Daily Planet or his Daily Planet? Oh my God. That's not...
How much PDF? I mean, PDAs. How much PDAs?
How many PDFs? In fact. No, I mean,
PDFs.
It's just like coming on very strong. Otherwise, I do like the art. Like that moment, I think, is overplayed. But generally, Guis sort of overwhelms the art. He's the regular penciler on Action Comics at this point. So he makes it look more like Action Comics kind of looks. I think like his inks are very heavy. But generally, I think this is good art, good expressive. The fight comes off well. What did you think of that fight with Bloody Mary? Who, again, I wish had more of a Roman connection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Alpha Centurion versus Bloody Mary. It's kind of weird. This archaic type icon versus a drink. And it's, you know, it's just weird.
But
it's
she's weird. Like a space pirate. She's got like the electric eye patch and the...
Yeah, she has a blade for a hand or, you know, it could be a hook.
Skull and crossbones on her little... flying saucer, and she uses like these really antiquated robots. She's a bit of a mishmash.
I kind of enjoyed those oldie type robots. They kind of look like the Cybermen a little bit, but not really. That kind of throwback to like old school comics, you know. Yeah.
You say Cybermen, but then I look at what the police force is using. So we still have Maggie Sawyer and we still have Harper, the Guardian. That force, but now they're called the 100, and they're flying around on these little platforms that look like they've beheaded some Daleks, just the underside, like those flying Daleks. I'm wondering, are those all kind of references to something? They look very, I'm going to say Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon as a sort of a general umbrella term, but they kind of have that like 50s science fiction
strip. It's like... retro future type stuff.
Yeah, and then, well, Bloody Mary's a bit too cyberpunk for that, but so it's a bit of a mix. I'm not sure what they're going for, if they're going for something, or they're just trying to make things look different. Like, Metropolis is a lot more art deco than usual and that kind of stuff, just to make it look different.
The one thing, very much so. I think they put a lot more thought into Alpha Centurion than they did into Bloody Mary, which is often the case. I mean, there are not a lot of villains that are well developed at first sight, you know, and they get better with time. But here, Bloody Mary, whatever.
Yeah. At least Alpha Centurion is meant to come back. Well, he's meant to continue in 0 Hour. So you want to get a handle on who this guy is. But the one-off villain who's part of another timeline is unlikely to return.
I don't know if they had like somebody in mind to play Superman in this, in this thing. Because Superman kind of looks a little bit off. Kind of feels like they're trying to make him look like someone. And he looks kind of a mix of like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone. I mean, Superman has this big chin, but I mean, he always looks nice. I don't think Superman looks like Superman in this comic.
And his hair is very long here, I think.
It's more than just a mullet. It's party everywhere. It's not just party in the back.
Here's a couple of trivia bits I picked up. Just like looking at the art closer, when we're seeing the Daily Planet headline for Centurion Saves Shuttle, like his first appearance, there are like these little articles that, you know, at the top of the newspaper, they send you to other booklets. Check out the B section and the C section. And there's like these little headlines there that you can hardly read. Well, I read them. So they say, one says, Carlin, quote, "You're late." That's obviously Mike Carlin, who is the editor of the Superman books and also the killer of the JSA. Obviously an editorial joke. Jurgens acquires Warners. So Dan Jurgens being the writer and artist of Zero Hour. Here they make like, in this reality, he owns the WB. And then the other one is a really deep cut. Hello Larry, top rated show. So this was, Hello Larry was a sitcom starring McLean Stevenson after he left MASH. Lasted two seasons, ended in 1980. And this is 1994. That's why I'm saying it's kind of a deep cut. But it had the reputation of being extremely terrible. In a 2002 edition of TV Guide, it was named one of the 50 worst shows of all time. So it was like a radio, like a WKRP or a Frasier kind of setup. And it was particularly unfunny. So obviously, this is legendary enough to to be an inside joke on this newspaper. And the other thing that I noted was a confusing footnote, because they tell us that Superman and Alpha Centurion didn't get a chance to compare notes in Zero Hour number 2. Like, they recognize each other from that scene. But issue number 2 hasn't come out yet. You know, at the end of the issue, we're told the story continues in Zero Hour number 2. So obviously they met Zero Hour number 3 that first time in the footnote, but it was the second issue of the series. See, it's confusing, DC, this whole countdown thing. The second issue was number 3. Mike Carlin, who was editing both, screwed up the footnote. I'm just saying. Dude. So is Alpha Centurion someone? Is Alpha Centurion hot or not? No. Is Alpha Centurion is Alpha Centurion someone you would like to see continue beyond Zero Hour is my question.
Well, you know what? I kind of dug him. I kind of like him. He has this, you know, this Black Knight type thing going. He's like a man out of time. I think I'd like to see him in the future, but like within a team thing, like in the Justice League or some other team where he has a particular type of vocabulary and, you know, he'd be fun, I think, like Thor within the other, you know, like in the Avengers.
Right.
I think he'd be a fun guy to have around within a team. I don't know if I'd read his book, but I'd sure like him in a team.
Well, he did return. Not this particular guy, because this particular guy has a history that is, you know, anathema to Superman's. They can't both have had this history. But they brought him back a year later. He came back to Earth from that alien voyage for the first time. He's got a slightly different look. I think it looks kind of better. He's got less A stuff. It's like he's got a big golden chest plate, and he's got like a different helmet that's more pointy a little bit.
Yeah.
More Trojan, I'm going to say, even though it's supposed to be Roman. And he allies with Superman. He's even part of a subgroup of Superman, the Rescue Squad, the Superman Rescue Squad. So he hangs around for a bit and even got it like his own special.
Nice.
One-issue special. And even today, he was in, well, today, you know, more recent times, he was in Multiversity. He's like on Earth 16. He's one of the heroes of Earth 16. If you're looking for him in the multiverse, as I know you you travel more than I do. He's their powerhouse hero on that Earth. So maybe he's the Superman of Earth 16. And he even appeared in the New 52. So people still remember him. You know, Alpha Centurion is, I think if they'd made like a alt Superman, he could have been forgotten. We saw an alt, like an Israeli Hawkman in the Hawkman issues. He's kind of that, right? Yeah. He's supposed to be like the alt as time is screwed up. There's like alt characters. But he's different enough that, well, let's not waste this IP. Let's do something with the Alpha Centurion. We can do things with him.
He's not the most original type superhero, but for the DC universe, he's like a little breath of fresh old air.
Some people have done similar things. I think Exo Manowar at Valiant is like a Visigoth brought to the present wearing like an alien armor. It's a lot like this. There's something to do with the man out of time idea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. At first glance, I thought because he has the same, you know, colors as Booster Gold and he's everywhere like Booster Gold. He has this big building right in the middle of Metropolis. So I thought, is this guy Booster Gold? And I found out he's not. But, you know, he has this appeal. He obviously is Metropolis's favorite. Everybody loves him. Even the police have the A thing on their floating boats.
Yeah, it's like you're wondering, is he like in some sort of leadership position? Is it like he's like the governor of Metropolis? It's like, is there like an imposed Roman order? Or
yeah, or is he just, you know, the really beloved champion? And, you know, I like to think it's the latter.
Well, he brought back some technology with him. Why would you have your own building and your own pool and your own servants? And it's like he's rich. So he brought back something that made him rich enough to finance the cops or the 100. I don't know if the 100 are actually the you know, the Metropolis Special Crimes Unit, or
maybe they're not police officers. Maybe they're just like his private military type thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's rich and popular and he's got like a celebrity status. The sort of stuff that Superman would never do.
Yeah.
He would never exploit his position that way. But the Alpha Centurion obviously did. And it obviously is the benefactor of Metropolis in the way that Lex Luthor sort of pretended to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we'll see him again through Zero Hour, obviously. And then when time resets, the Alpha Centurion exists in our world, but in a different version, of course, that we're not going to get to cover. But we'll take a small break at this point. And we'll come back to talk about Steel.
Attention, attention all personnel. New from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, it's MASHcast. Hosted by MASH mega fan Rob Kelly and a rotating cast of VIPs, MASHcast analyzes episode by episode the greatest television series of all time, MASH. Find MASHcast on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Jocularity! We're back. We're talking about Steel. First, let's just discuss where he was in 1994. He was a relatively new character. He was one of the replacement Supermen from Reign of the Supermen, and like Superboy, scored a solo series after the event. It was written by his co-creator, Louise Simonson. His first appearance was actually in Adventures of Superman number 500, barely much more than a year before Zero Hour. So, you know, we're only at issue 8, and that's because he's left the Superman books, forge his own destiny. In his series, he moves to Washington, D.C. We meet his rather large extended family, and he forges a new armor, which doesn't have the big S on the front because he thought, well, maybe I'm going to be going up against some dudes that, you know, I'm going to break the law in. I don't want to be like throwing shade at Superman because I'm somehow associated with him. But the armor was supposed to be more powerful as well. So it's got a slightly different look than in the Superman, the Man of Steel, where he starred during Reign of the Superman. So this could have been an easy one to miss, Bass, because they didn't put the Zero Hour banner on it for some reason.
That's what's going on with the... I was like, why? What's not there? Seems to be something not there with the cover. And that's what it is. There's no...
also not there, any villains I care about. But
why isn't the Zero Hour logo on there?
I don't know. I think, obviously, somebody forgot. Somebody didn't notice. It's also very subtle. The time anomaly thing is kind of subtle.
Yeah.
If you flip through the pages, you don't even notice it. So you really have to read the story to realize that there's something weird going on. But... Yeah, so this is one that some people trying to collect Zero Hour and all its tie-ins frequently miss. So I've seen people talk about this and go, oh, damn, this was part of it? And yes, it was. It's not a big part of it, but it is a part of it. So the cover has Steel getting hit by, there are three villains there that are throwing everything they've got. They are not people you'd recognize. So we'll find out who they are in the issue itself. But I think that was one of my things about the Steel series was that it never seemed to... It tried to create its own world. And in doing so, it created a lot of 90s villains that never returned, that were so associated with Steel. They all seem very disposable. It just doesn't integrate into the DC universe as well as it should. But what about you? I know you didn't read the Steel series, but...
I didn't read the Steel series. He was probably my favorite Superman replacement.
Yeah, yeah.
From all the Men of Steel. In that moment, I thought that was very clever to actually make a Man of Steel. He was basically a copy of Iron Man at that point, you know, exoskeleton type thing, very mobile, rocket boots and everything. I did love that big-ass hammer he had, because, I mean, his name is John Henry. I just love that. Honestly, even without the big S on the front of the armor, that iconic huge red cape just does it for me. I just love it.
Yeah, I think I liked it better with the S, personally, or that old armor didn't have like the black pants and the black, you know, shirt kind of deal that this has. I like the original one. I thought the original one looked a little more industrial, a little bulkier, like the thing that shot nails, that shot train track nails. Yeah. So it looked cooler to me and more of a silver tone. But I mean, regardless of the armor, he looks like himself. You recognize him. You know, he's as iconic as the Iron Man armor. The Iron Man armor changes a lot too, and we always recognize it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Steel was always one of my favorites. I never really saw him evolve. I have a couple, you know, I have some Superman books, and he's in some of them.
And he joined the JLA at some point as well, the Grant Morrison's.
Always, in my opinion, underused. You know, he's one of those brilliant minds that should have been used differently, I think. In my opinion, we never really saw how brilliant this guy was. We always saw him, you know, whacking stuff with the hammer and the engineer. We never really saw him.
I think that was done better in JLA for sure. I feel like this is the guy they should. You know, when DC was struggling to find, like, to upgrade, let's say, African-American heroes. I do mean struggling. I mean, it's like, why is Cyborg, a Teen Titan, in the Justice League, you know, post New 52 and in the movies? Why isn't it Steel?
Yeah, really?
It should be Jon Stewart. It should be Steel. It should be, I mean, these characters are older, have, you know, the Cyborg is a good character, but I mean, he's a Teen Titan and he feels like a teenager and he feels like he should be with that group. Whereas, like, Steel should have his own book all the time. I feel like Steel is, you're right, the Iron Man of the DC universe.
Yeah.
And he came in at a time when Iron Man wasn't particularly popular. It's not like, oh, this is the ripoff Iron Man because Iron Man is so popular, which he is now. Iron Man really, like, jumped to the popular, you know, at the top of the line, at the front of the line, because of his movies.
Exactly. I mean, I remember when the Iron Man movie came out, it was, you know, a lesser-known superhero movie.
Right. People were going, who is this, you know, obscure Marvel character? Why not another Spider-Man movie?
Yeah, and they had to put the Black Sabbath song in there, you know, the Iron Man, it's a great song, but I don't think people really knew who Iron Man was. I loved Iron Man. I mean, I was a kid. I read Iron Man. I was even too young to read the drunk Iron Man stuff.
Yeah, no, me too, for that matter.
I didn't really get it.
I jumped in with Armor Wars, which was just after that. Well. But by the 90s, they, you know, they went, oh, let's these characters aren't selling. Let's push them into a side universe as drawn by the image artist like Rob Liefeld, full-chested Captain America, and you had like this super manga-ish Iron Man. So it's like the 90s for Iron Man were terrible. It was either he was in that side universe or he came back and he was like a teenager, like he'd been regressed as a teenager. So Steel doesn't feel like, oh, they ripped off a popular character. It's a normal superhero trope, the guy in the armor. There are a lot of these characters.
Yeah. I mean, he's different enough to be Steel. I mean, he's not Iron Man. And in certain ways, he's better. I believe he has this cooler, iconic shape, you know, with that Superman cape, but the big industrial type armor type thing. He looks like we just talked about him, but he looks like a centurion. You know, he looks like a warrior. I mean, I just loved him. I really loved Steel. Did not see the Shaq movie. I did not see the Shaq movie.
Neither did I.
I will someday.
It's hammer time.
I would like right now to see Steel make a comeback in the comic books, be the smart guy in the JLA. I'd love that.
I feel like he wasn't given the proper chance. When you go to a movie, I mean, he was interesting enough to get a movie, but then obviously it was a terrible one. Even this series was really low-key. If it had been more, I don't know. We're going to talk about the issue, but I think it is a good example of the issues of Steel, which yeah. are kind of mired in the same. This is what I remember of the series. It's like, okay, it's like this long soap opera kind of story with villains I don't give a crap about. He's got a large family that's interesting, but it grounded a hero that could have been, like, that was sort of built to be epic in the streets of Washington, D.C., and it felt like so grounded and yet could have been more bombastic just because the character is so powerful that I felt it couldn't find, I don't know. And if it kept John Bogdanov, who was the original artist, who had much more, you know, bombastic art, who was more associated with the character, if they kept him in addition to Louise Simonson, maybe it could have gone somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
But I felt like it was a step down. Now, nothing against Chris Bautista or any of the other artists that worked on it. Not at all. But it just felt like a step down from what we saw in the Reign of the Superman.
To be fair, I think Steel had that greatness factor that he could have at least stolen one or two bad guys from Superman. Mm. Kind of like, you know how Nightwing kind of got the Penguin? Inherited the Penguin, and he got a couple of the Batman bad guys. I think Steel, he should have gotten a couple of these, you know, even some of the quirky ones, even like the Toy Man. I mean, it would have been like Engineer versus Engineer, at least, or something. Yeah, I don't know, but
both books, this one and Superboy, both did the same thing in a way, created its own supporting cast, its own. You know, it kind of didn't want to steal too much from the Superman books because those were written by the same people, really. It's like, well, let's play with another. Like, Superboy is sent to Honolulu, Hawaii at any rate, and he's got all these new villains as well. I think in Superboy, it worked better. Superboy was more lighthearted. Carl Kiesel was adept at creating villains that were, you know, fun and different from one another. And then the art was also quite vibrant. And amusing. So you could do many more things in Superboy than you could in Steel because I think for me, Louise Simonson, I love Louise Simonson as a writer. I've loved her Power Pack. I've read all her X Factor and of course all her Superman books, Star Yours. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but she's not very good at villains. I feel like when she creates villains in the Superman, the Man of Steel, we had like Cerebus, which was like an organization full of like weird creatures and monstrous superhumans. And it's like, well, I remember none of these now. So it was kind of like that. And even one of the X-Men villain or X-related villains that she created or co-created that I cannot care about is Apocalypse. And, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, I feel like, I don't know where these designs come from. I mean, obviously, there's an artist involved, but I always dislike the designs as much as... And then I don't feel anything for the characters. So maybe villains weren't her strong suit or something. I don't know, but I have trouble naming a Louise Simonson-created villain that I really do like.
Villains are hard because you have to treat them well, and nobody wants to like the villain, but, you know.
Like, she's very good at characterization. Especially doing kids and, you know, like obviously from Power Pack, but she can do generational stuff and she can do like the characterization stuff. Creating villains, I don't feel like I can name a single Louise Simonson villain that I enjoy, but I may not be thinking of them. You know, I like the snarks in Power Pack, but it's, you know, it's not like super villains. Yeah. I always feel like they're monsters or something. Monsters or power sets and suits or something. Let's talk about Steel number 8. It is by Louise Simonson.
We didn't talk about it yet. No, not yet.
Louise Simonson, Chris Bautista is the penciler, inkers Rich Faber and Andrew Pepoy. It's called The Challenge. Steel returns home to Washington, D.C. after recent events in Metropolis, and we get to check up on his family, including a nephew that's in a wheelchair after being shot and another who is struggling with the fact that the bullet was meant for him and whether or not he should take tar, a drug that apparently makes you super strong. I guess like Venom. By the end of the story, he'll have realized he shouldn't, and that he won't. The main plot concerns a superpowered group called Black Ops, who are setting up operations all over the world, and who want Steel out of the way, seeing as DC is their current HQ. They follow Steel's family, to the Vietnam War Memorial, hoping to ambush him there. When he shows up in full armor, they send a first wave of supervillains after him. At the same time, a younger version of John Henry is also in the area and helps his future self by throwing a rock at one of the villains' heads without really knowing what's happening. Steel rallies and defeats the opponents, who then teleport away. While young John Henry figures out he's been displaced in time, he, at that same time, vanishes back into the time stream. Hazard, the leader of Black Ops, vows to get Steel's armor. That's our story.
There's a lot of people we don't know and will not care about in this thing. I kind of like the fact that young John Henry is just there with no explanation, really. So, yeah, I kind of like that, because for a couple minutes I was like, okay, why is that guy all over the place? And then we find out that it's, you know, John Henry Irons from another time. I mean, he is still heroic without the suit, so it's a nice show of that character also.
Yeah, because it's covert. Like, the 0 hour temporal anomaly is really hidden, where this kid walks around, he meets John Henry's grandma, and she says, oh, you look like my grandson. And he says, oh, you look like my grandma, except my grandma has black hair. She hasn't grayed yet, you know? So, and they leave it at that. And it's like, okay, who's this kid that reminds her of, you know, it's like when he doesn't recognize the Vietnam War Memorial because it was built after that particular time in his timeline, then we start to, okay. And then this is the weird part for me, or the bizarre temporal moment, is when young John Henry throws a rock at this villain's head. Steel thinks right on schedule. So at that moment, Steel's mind is updated or whatever, but Steel remembers being there as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I didn't get that.
Yeah. So it's like suddenly, and probably because of the time anomalies, suddenly during that fight, he realizes, hey, déjà vu, I've seen this.
Huh.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess so. Yeah.
But it's the only real acknowledgement of this, you know, happening, because then the other John Henry disappears back into the time stream. People go, who was that guy? You know, where'd he go?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Steel doesn't mention it again.
Yeah, that's true.
Usually it would be like people are brought in from the past, but not, we haven't seen, I don't think we have seen yourself coming back, you know, coming up through time or something. We've seen a lot of permutations of this, but I don't think we've seen this particular.
Well, this is a same universe, different time. We've seen a lot of different universes, different time.
I guess the two bad girls did get to speak, but it was always, hey, bad girl, what are you doing here? And it's not like Barbara's going, oh yeah, I remember this. No, she's going, this doesn't make sense. You know, this is the bad girl that it was an alternate universe bad girl who never got shot by the Joker or whatever.
Yeah.
They haven't done this particular thing where it is him and it actually affects his memories. So I thought this was a clever little anomaly, but just no pizzazz. This is exactly what I was talking about earlier. I like this. I like how subtle it is. But how are you going to get readers excited when you don't even put the 0 hour on it, so people aren't buying it for the complete 0 hour experience, where you might have gotten extra readers from this? So again, it's like Steel is just getting the shaft from editorial or whoever's making up these, you know, like mocking up the covers, or I mean, what is this mistake? But also, it doesn't have a big wow factor, you know? It's like this very subtle thing where I feel like Steel's adventure should be epic in some way.
Maybe, just maybe, they weren't supposed to have this little anomaly and they put it in there.
Like, okay, redraw a couple pages, Chris Bautista, because we need to fit some 0 hour in there or something.
I guess.
At the same time, Steel was just coming back from another crossover event, because at the beginning of this, he's saying goodbye to Superman. And they've just been involved in something called Worlds Collide, which was a crossover between the Superman books and the Milestone comics, from which came Hardware, which is another Iron Man, Static, and all of those guys. They live, you know, across the veil in another universe, even though there's only one Earth in this particular version of the DC universe. So in this other dimension are all the Milestone heroes, you know? So there was a crossover between the Superman books and that, where Steel obviously takes part. And here they're saying goodbye at the end of this. So I've always felt like Worlds Collide was so close to Zero Hour, it should have been part of Zero Hour. Should have been, yeah. People should have been talking about how this was also a weird anomaly that was being caused by time shenanigans. It never was.
Absolutely. It should have been.
Because it's right at the beginning of this, you're talking about, like, well, Worlds Collide was fun. Bye. Shit. Zero Hour. Zero Hour's already here. What the? You know, it's like there's no room to breathe between the two events. So to me.
Yeah.
But it's also weird that beginning where I feel like Superman and Steel are talking to each other like they've just only met. Is it me? Or it's like, well, you did a real good job. Want to move to Metropolis? You know, we could use a guy like you. It's like, haven't you guys known each other for a year?
Aren't you guys really friends, actually?
Shouldn't they be or something? I don't know. Maybe I just...
In all the Superman books I do have, I mean, they're like close friends. Maybe it's too formal. I don't know.
Let's evaluate these villains. Okay?
Let's
because Hazard's first wave, and this is a very confusing thing for me in all of this, is that like the organization's called Black Ops, but then sometimes they just call it Hazard, but I think that's the main guy's name. The guy with the ponytail is called Hazard, maybe? Whatever. Okay. I don't care enough to check. So Hazard's first wave are like the three villains that attack Steel, but we see two other superpowered villains in here that are part of Black Ops. So they've got these 90s names. Flatline, Hotspot, Quake, and then there's also Shell Game, aka Shell Shock, because somebody calls her something else by mistake. Editorial really needs to get on this. I mean, what is this? And Split, the teleporter is called Split. Did any of these actually strike your fancy?
Not in
the slightest. Not even like Hotspot. She's made of fire.
Hotspot is probably the coolest character or the coolest villain in there, but she's beaten by a fountain. So,
I mean, throw her in the pond there in DC, the mall.
And I mean, her look is cool, but you know, the other guy there, the guy with the headband, I mean, he's just too much.
He's the one that says, catch the wave, right? I mean, it's like, oh, God.
Yeah. Oh. But, you know, all of these are basically, if you've ever played a superhero video game and you clicked random.
Like a City of Heroes.
Yeah. If you click random on the costume, this is what you get. The only one that seemingly has some kind of thought in there is Hotspot. But the costume is very, very basic.
Yeah, no, she's got, I don't know, she's got like a, they've all got that patch with their, I don't know, like Quake has a Q and they all each have, Flatline has like a little electroscope thing. Hotspot has flames maybe. And then otherwise, there's some lines to it and like a Spider-Man mask kind of deal.
Yeah. What's the other one? Split?
Split teleports at the end. It's just like dressed in shorts.
Yeah, she has, you know, she's ready for the gym, basically. Villains that you press random on a random costume selector, and this is what you got.
No, I agree. I think Hotspot was probably the best design. And on the cover, ironically, is the one that you don't notice. Because she's not with the other, she's not with the rest of the grouping. Like Quake is doing like this hand slap thing. And that's central. But then she's on the other side of the costume. And because the cover is basically yellow and she's yellow, it took me like a couple of tries to actually see her. Again, that's like not great villain. And even when you see like Hazard in a costume, which is a scene in their HQ, it's just like this purple and silver number. Again, it's very generic. He's got this floppy 90s haircut, you know?
Yeah.
So it was popular back then. I feel like none of these villains are... Well, interesting enough to be to come back or be anything, but also that they're like grounded in a particular era. You look at them and you say, well, this is a 90s design, and then the 90s are done and we never see them again. You know, it's like.
And that's what happened, right?
That's pretty much what. I think that's what happened. Do you have more affection for what you saw of Steel's family?
Yeah. You know what? I always wanted to read Steel. I never really read it. And I might just try to, you know, grab back copies or trade paperbacks.
Probably just like in the back issue, like, you know, the cheap issue bins. Yeah, I'm not even sure there is a trade paperback. Because, yes, there's like, I like the idea that he has like this big family. And this is early days yet. So they've got their storylines, but we also meet Dr. Amanda Quick in this. She's treating the kid that got shot. And she's going to be Steel's love interest. She's going to be his Lois Lane, basically. She's going to know his identity. She's going to share in the adventure. So she becomes more important later on as well. So we're really seeing the building blocks. Even we're at issue 8, but we got to remember Steel just probably lost a couple issues on Worlds Collide, where he was taken away mm-hmm. from his storyline. So it's still very early for him at this point. One of the things, I mean, Amanda Quick here is indeed quick to notice that John Henry is a handsome man. But I feel like everybody in this comic has the hots for John Henry Irons or Steel, regardless of which one he is.
Well,
you know, it's yeah, like everybody's everybody's going, whoo, which I think is an interesting thing.
I go woo when I see Steel. I mean, he's tall, dark, he's handsome. I mean, hey.
What a magnetic personality.
We gotta admit, the guy's got style.
His Bod by Bog is the... he's got a shirt that says that. It's obviously Bogdanov, his original artist, who did create the Bod, I guess. Obviously, he's got an appeal to us. He's got an appeal to the people inside the comic. I like the idea that he's in a city that does exist. It is not Metropolis, and he's doing something else somewhere else. But overall, I always felt like the series kind of landed flat for me. So I think your idea is good. Maybe we should, you know, look at this whole series and see how it actually went and see it as this little snapshot of the hero's life and maybe find some joy there.
I will definitely try and I mean, I always liked them. I never really went forward to, you know, seek him out. But I will now, and hopefully Steel will make a huge comeback. I mean, he has all the potential that these great superheroes have. I mean, he could be DC's Iron Man easily.
Even on TV, why did we get fake Ted Kord, the Atom, in an armor when we had Steel? Every time they need an armored hero, why aren't you going to Steel? You know?
Yeah.
At this point, I feel like hardware has more of a shot. I don't know. I guess Steel, I think, has a lot of fans, and I don't think they're being catered to.
Come on.
DC's listening to this, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Come on, DC. Come on.
We'll take a short break, and then when we return, your feedback on our previous episode.
Jeff and Merc present Unpacking the Power of Power Pack,
where we journey through each issue of the most underrated Marvel series of the 80s while drinking beer,
analyzing awesome and amazing adolescent adventures, and absorbing alcohol.
We got kids with powers, we got villains with attitude.
We got superhero guests, like all of them from the Marvel Universe.
We have thematically appropriate beer reviews.
We have good jokes and bad song parodies.
One stop for all your Power Pack pod-pleasing procurements.
And we got alliteration.
Find Unpacking the Power of Power Pack wherever fine podcasts are played.
Costumes on.
Letters lost in time.
Letters lost in time.
Excerpts from your comments on our coverage of Zero Hour number 3. We all remember what happened in that one.
Oh, yeah.
JSA superfan Chris Franklin. Well, we know his opinion on the JSA murder, but he says, needless to say, I was really pissed after reading this issue back in the day, and ultimately it's Zero Hour's biggest black eye to me. It's not so much that the JSA die and are unilaterally defeated. It's more the way they are just portrayed as lambs unto the slaughter. Their sacrifice doesn't buy the other heroes anything, really, because they are still clueless at this point. In Crisis on Infinite Earths, Flash and Supergirl's deaths meant something and moved the heroes closer to their goals. But the veteran hero team is just taken out like chumps, and editorial hands are all over this. I think I had already heard why the wonderful and well-selling Justice Society of America series was canceled a year earlier. Mike Carlin felt the title was an embarrassment to DC line. These old fogies were holding the new heroes and potential new readers back. Needless to say, I disagree. And time has proven him very wrong. And I guess you, Chris, very right. Not everybody is on the same page. Michael Bailey, for example, he says, when Zero Hour came out, I was not the fan of the JSA that I would eventually become. I remember reading this issue and going, oh man, I kind of like those characters, but it didn't bug me like it would have if I'd read it 6 years later, which is why I can ultimately give it a pass while still disliking it. And here's the thing. Without this, I don't think we would have gotten Starman, or Starman would not have turned into what it turned into. That was kind of a safe house for the Golden Age characters, a place for them to go and stay away from everyone they wanted that wanted them to die or to just disappear. And without Starman being as good as it was, we wouldn't have gotten the JSA title in 1999. So I guess what I'm saying is that a lot of people had to be mad for me to find something I loved. Well, everything's part of a continuum, isn't it?
Yeah. It's all...
That's why regret serves no purpose.
Still there. It's still there, Mike. It's still there.
If you hadn't made that mistake, would you still be in the same place you are now? Of course, where you are now is terrible. I get it. You know, eventually the universe reboots. Don't worry. David Hayes Gutierrez says, when I read this all those years ago, my thought was, oh, okay, geezers put out to pasture, no big loss. Says, I like Flash 1, but come on, how long can that guy run? And for Sentinel, Green Lantern, well, I hate magic heroes, so it isn't that big a deal. So, okay, Dag. And then I read James Robinson's The Golden Age, and I thought, man, what a send-off for a boatload of characters I don't really care about, but now I do. You just need the right story, right?
You just need the right story, and that story was not it.
But honestly, I'm glad they got sidelined. Keep in mind the attitude of DC at the time. One True Lantern, the stage was set for a new Green Arrow, the Flash Wally was really coming to his own. So did we need another Flash running around? My point is, DC was into simplifying, and I liked that. I felt like the Golden Age heroes were my dad's heroes, and Wally West, Kyle Rayner, etc. were mine. That said, I'm older now, I'm probably a couple of Dick Grayson's old. My heroes have fallen away, and that's cool. And now I realize there was room for everyone.
Aww.
Who else? Diablo Frank, as usual, went through the whole journey with us, leaving comments timestamp by timestamp. He says he hates the timestamps, actually, which are meaningless and generally used to cover bad or unclear writing. It also begs the question, or many questions, like, why are the assembled heroes talking about their bold new directions for so long before getting to brass tacks? He adds, I often complain about books from this period not giving the reader enough information, but Superman Splainer, Kid Pucci, and Mexposition sure tell me everything I need to know. He's also quite hard on Jurgen's art, feeling that the 90s extreme costumes are drained of all fun under his pencil, so that big group shot turns out to be boring.
It is.
He calls the Hawkman transfiguration scene a rainbow bright Care Bear stare triple Lindy synchronized fart. That, again, is just like fails to pop out of the page. And likens the bit with Extant torturing the JSA to Windows 95 screensavers. So he also brings up the point that interviews in Wizard magazine at the time told us who was going to be killed. So there wasn't even any shock value. Those are all fair points, Frank.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't disagree. I think for all the, you know, Dan Jurgens is a solid comic book artist, but it kind of feels, you know, we keep switching scenes and it's just like people standing around, or, you know, no real backgrounds, or it doesn't feel rushed because, like, the anatomy's good and you got Jerry Ordway on the inks, but it's just like, I don't know. Is there enough thought to making it dynamic? I don't know. Tim Price was a JSA fan and was heartbroken when the Mike Parabek series was canceled after 10 issues, which was a year before Zero Hour. So it was still close enough. He did care about their deaths here. But Jurgens didn't work hard enough to make me care, he says, in that issue. Their treatment in Zero Hour was upsetting for the wrong reasons. I wanted to care about the JSA's deaths, and instead it fell flat. And then we have Bradley Null, says, this issue's negative memories. I'm a fan of Alan and the JSA. This was the issue that I bought where I learned I was not getting the multiverse back. I was the guy who liked Hal as a bad guy. So this was, how can you like that, yelled at me repeatedly at that time. So quite beyond just like the Zero Hour. Other fans were heckling him. So company killed off or shelved some of his favorites. Editing is blocking a thing he likes. Fans are now what we call toxic. All the worst parts of the hobby hit me that week. I stopped hanging out at that store and found a less argumentative comic book shop not long after that. Jeez. And Ward Hill Terry says, when I decided 20 or so years ago to get back into collecting comics by just focusing on the Legion and the JSA, this was one of the books that I had to buy. Until then, I hadn't known of it. I bought it. I read it. It's lousy. I haven't reread it. And listening to your description of it does not inspire me to reread it. Chris's interpretation above nails it. This is a top-down event. Things happen because they need to happen because upper management has decreed it. So we're gonna leave it on that point. On that note, we have to mention that the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. If you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Get on the zero list at patreon.com/FWPodcast, just like these fine folks did. They got on the zero list, and that means they are going to escape the cataclysmic time wave that's coming from both ends of history. Jim Ball has been saved from the Big Bang just as he glimpsed the giant hand. David Capoon has been saved from the contemporary metropolis as he was waiting for an interview at the LexCorp offices. Michael Bailey has been saved from the Time Traveler's Citadel at the end of time. What were you doing there? Investigating the pocket Earth, probably. A reminder that you can leave us comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also follow Fire and Water's Facebook page. And on Twitter, the account is FW Podcast. You can also now find the podcast on Spotify, if that's how you prefer to get your podcast delivered right to your door. Just search for Zero Hour Strikes. Indeed, most, if not all, of Fire and Water Network shows are now available on that platform.
Next time on Zero Hour Strikes, Zero Hour number 2.